This is August 11th. We have Dave Worster on the phone again 24 hours later, and we're just going to pick up where we left yesterday. And this is August 11th, 2008. Okay, we're talking about Conrad Keeler, known as Connie, and Bob has met him at an Ed Reinhardt, Ken Reinhardt session. And here's what Dave, I want to read you what he says about Conrad. He says, Conrad took to the writings of Krishnamurti like a duck to water. He seemed to have an ability to understand and a desire to go to the bottom of things. His interest was not just a response to his failed marriage or being stuck in a rut, but it came from the core of his being. I was very happy to find someone who was the same age as I and with whom I could share my thoughts. Conrad preferred to be called Connie, his nickname. Most of the center members liked him very much, but of course there were some who felt jealous of him. In a way, I was like a swami, was supposed to be impartial and open and have unconditional love for all, but I didn't have unconditional love. I kept myself separate, living in my ivory tower. I was just like anyone else in this world, but the price of being a guru was the distance I needed to maintain. And now I had a friend with whom I could share a part of my life. As time passed, we grew very close to each other, yet there was a part of me that was still his teacher, Connie's teacher. He looked to me as one who knew and could help him in his own search for understanding. We spent all of our free time together and shared our lives. For Connie, this was something different. He had been close to his army buddies, but had never felt this close with someone before. For me, it gave the feeling of being able to share my feelings with someone else. Connie became a source of my strength and helped fill the vacuum of being alone. All my life, I felt that I was an outsider and would never be able to fit into the world with all its morality and codes of conduct. I would never be able to fall into the rut of convention. My whole life had been a reaction against the status quo. Being with Connie gave me a sense of comfort as well as a feeling that here there was someone who really cared. So would you agree with that, that Connie
was... Yep. Yes, I would.
Did you become close to Connie?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we were all buddies, especially when the LSD occurred. The awareness and the ability to interrelate was such that many times when things would occur that were quite interesting and phenomenal or right on, there would be just like maybe a look exchange and a smile and a nod or something like that. A lot of that went on. Because we tried to be nonverbal around other people during the sessions. Because our verbality could accidentally suggest something and trigger off something in their psyche. And the point was to only give minor instructions on just how to keep moving through. And then sometimes distract them with... things just to pull them out of a little whirl, bad trip, you know.
And you do that verbally or do something else to distract?
Usually, in order to get their attention right away, you just say, look at that, and kind of point at it, and they would move their attention to it, and then you didn't have to do very much except do that and then let it go. And by that time, more awareness had come into their psyche in the shift. And so they would have more awareness as they went back into the whirlpool and would be able to go deeper before going unconscious.
Right.
And so we had this technique, usually about three distractions during one of those periods would be enough for someone to cycle through the seed thought and go down deep until they got into an area that was clear, which would essentially unhook synaptic connections that were firing off that had to do with conditionings that no longer need be functioning. But see, we didn't have to describe any of that because they were experiencing it, and our awareness of this process was quite phenomenal. We got a lot of things done very fast, and in the sense that our whole principle was that if somebody hadn't had a bad trip within the first hour or so, then we played records that would take them through experiences that could lead into so-called bad trips. And the whole purpose of that was to get them in and in contact with their conditioning and then help it unhook. So by the time they'd had about 20 bad trips during an eight-hour sessions, the fact that they came through and out of all those meant that they probably would never have any problems in that area again. That's why we had 1,500 acid sessions among 75 people in the 3 years, and no after effects or bad trips. There was one that was kind of odd, but it worked out.
Okay, let's go into that when we get into that.
Yeah, okay.
But so in your mind, you would have memories of looking at Connie in these intense states, that he's a face communicating back with you. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And, of course, he would josh me and kid me like he kid Robert, and then we would kid back and stuff, you know. It's like one time, oh, this was later, when I was talking about the first acid session, you know. And he was driving this Corvette, and
Robert or Connie? Robert?
Connie was driving, and Robert was in the middle, and I was in the passenger seat. Anyway, I mentioned the first acid session, and both of them started to laugh uproariously, and said, "Don't you realize this is still the same one?"
who said
this was years later. That was about 1966, I think. You know, the other one would date back to 1957. He said, "Don't you realize it's still the same one?" Which goes to show how our group consciousness kind of occurred even after we stopped all of it. And we weren't having flashbacks either. It's just that the awareness would be high, and at various times it would lower down while we take care of business, but then when we weren't taking care of business, it would shift out. And so that the consciousness that we were living in was almost like the highest, clearest acid sessions you had in everyday life. And sometimes I still do it today.
Yeah. Now, that was Connie or Bob that made that remark?
Connie made the remark, yeah. but Bob was looking and laughing with great glee in agreement.
Okay, so I'm going to read what he says in the next paragraph. He describes, you know, Bob Carr's describing his problem or how his sense of being the teacher and his post-Krishnamurti awareness of the dilemma of it. So he says...
Uh-huh.
And I won't read too many of these introspective kind of paragraphs, but this is a good transition one, good sample.
Uh-huh.
He goes, "One begins to live out the projections that the followers create. You have to act out the image that your disciples create about you. You are a prisoner of your own desire to fulfill the role of the teacher, the one who knows. The followers want to know what you have, and your job is to create the illusion that you have something they don't. That was the game I had been playing, and that game was now creating a prison. The more I assume the role of a teacher as a means to create a better understanding between myself and the members of the center, the deeper the illusion became for both myself, the teacher, for himself, the teacher, and my followers. My interest in what Krishnamurti had to say about our lives provided an insight into my problems, but this was not a pleasant experience. I saw that most seekers imagine that understanding adds something to their lives. Quote, I'll get some more frosting for my cake. I'll get happiness, money, and love," was what the seekers think. "But I was discovering that it added nothing. Understanding added nothing. Instead, it takes away your possessions, your wants, your beliefs, your wanting to be in a permanent state of contentment. There's no longer the fear of not getting what you think you want. There's no relationship whatsoever, and you cannot possibly be free of the image that you have of yourself or the image of you that your followers have created. I was realizing that searching was based on the idea of getting something or arriving at some state of permanence. Now, did he ever discuss that kind of thinking with you at that time?
Well, I know that sometimes in his talks that there was an introspective thing that was happening to him as he talked. So he was, in a sense, channeling but resourcing his own experience as the triggers. And those were quite impressive to me and to others. It kind of, some of the others thought, boy, he really gets Krishnamurti, doesn't he? That not only the words of Krishnamurti, but he's getting into the trip that's close to what Krishnamurti is himself, you know. It was that, and of course that encouraged everybody else deeper, and so then we had a whole bunch of people that were almost functioning in that way, and this was even before LSD come along.
Right, so you were a student of Bob Carr at that point, before the
LSD. Well, I felt I was. I moved in. I'd had this incredible experience. I hadn't sorted it out, and with everybody else that I checked, this is the only one that seemed to have a connection on a capacity to sort it out. And so that's what I was doing and discovering, and he was apparently discovering at the same time. So when you have that kind of intellectual excitement, it's very different from ordinary learning.
Yeah. Okay, now that reminds me, I did finish the book, finished the last part of his Growing Up in America chapter, where he talks about going to Las Vegas, and he says nothing about the experience. So you have referred to it before, but why don't you just sort of lay it out for the record? What is the story he told about Las Vegas?
Well, there were several different stories. I remember one where there was one of his associates got hit on the head or something, and when he came out of the coma, the only word he would use for about 2 or 3 weeks was wonderful. He would walk through the lobbies and sit in the lobbies and walk through the clubs and et cetera. He'd look around and he'd just say, wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. It went on and on. So anyway, it was during that time that he was a drag queen magician.
Oh, I didn't know. He does not describe his costume.
Yeah.
He doesn't say that. He's just a magician.
Well, he wore a, as I recall, it was a lavender blue gown that had no, it just covered his breasts, and it was not very long, and there was no place for him to hide anything in the gown. He couldn't,
Yeah.
It was all, in other words, his upper arms and chest and everything were all exposed, and there was no place to hide lit cigarettes.
Yeah.
But somehow or other, he pulled out, as the finale of his act, he pulled out 6 lit cigarettes. This is his routine, and it was phenomenal. But one night when he was all, everybody was really with it, etc., he passed out 9. And he couldn't figure out where the other 3 came from. And so he quit and went back to Portland, and the rest of the stuff.
Right. Now, he doesn't say that's the reason. What was going on was his mother was dying. And he was 22, he says. This is 1950. And he worked at the Last Frontier Casino, and he was only booked in for a month. And he did that, and he did well at it. But then he had nowhere to go. He wasn't booked anymore, so he went to Hollywood. And he found he was disillusioned with the nightclub life in Hollywood. And he found it's not as exciting as what he experienced in Las Vegas. Even though Las Vegas was a boring town, there was a lot more going on in Hollywood. And he says, the club was small, and I was crammed onto a tiny stage. So maybe the club itself was smaller than Las Vegas. People weren't interested in my attempts to entertain them. boozers and petty crooks, hustlers and hookers. They were all there. I had a clear view of the cutthroat side of show business, the competitive struggle that went on. The club was known for its long-standing star, famous lesbian singer, well-known in the Hollywood scene. Does that remind you of anybody? Famous
lesbian. A lesbian who probably dressed in men's clothes.
Just a famous lesbian singer.
Yeah, there was one I recall, probably in the same time frame, that she looked... She looked like a handsome young man, dressed completely as a man, and cut her hair like a man, and had a moderately low voice. Anyway, she was a great singer, and really people really loved her. She was, like she'd have really gone she'd really gone someplace if she'd have been a man.
Okay, so you were in Hollywood around that time yourself, weren't you?
Well, I don't know, you see, because how old was he?
22, so he's talking...
Well, we were there when, let's see, I was still 21 and 22, yeah.
Pretty well.
He's 6 months older than I am, so it's possible...
Okay, so without want to get distracted. So he says he's...
But I didn't remember this. This is news to me, this thing of his going to Hollywood. He didn't mention it.
Yeah, he says...
To me.
Yeah, he says, between the shows, he had to stay in the dressing room, whereas in Las Vegas, he could go out and mingle with the customers and the entertainers backstage, and he had a lot more freedom. But in Hollywood, we were not allowed to mix with the customers. It was boring to spend all that time locked up. As it were, I did two shows a night and could leave after the second intermission. He did his shows during the intermission. And it was just before Christmas. I was living on Hollywood Boulevard. It was a strange place. I was not used to the warm weather. It just didn't feel like Christmas. During the days, I would wander around Hollywood exploring the shops and well-known spots. And he got a call from his father saying his mother was dying, so he kind of used that as an excuse to leave Hollywood. And he intended to go back, but after his mother died, he went back to Hollywood for a month. And he says, the Hollywood, he said, the week passed slowly, and I decided to go back to Hollywood to sort out my future there after his mother died. After working another month, I did decide to come back to Portland to help my dad. The Hollywood scene came to an end. Then he goes, but the timing was all off. And I'm not sure what the timing is. He says, I gave my notice, and when my commitment was up, I said goodbye to my friends and took the train back to Portland. And then he ends by saying, trying to work in local nightclubs in the vicinity of Portland was difficult. I worked here and there, but it became obvious that I would have to go back out on the road if I wanted to make ends meet. It seemed that my short experience in the magic business was coming to an end, and that's the end. So he doesn't mention...
Well, now, I may be wrong, but I thought his mother died when he was 18, and I don't remember for sure, you see. And that he was underage when he was performing in Las Vegas. I think he was...
Yeah, he says he changed his card to make it look like he was 21. He does mention that.
Yeah, well, I think... anyway.
Okay. So he says that... when he started being a magician, when he was 15, 16, 17, he used the name Carob. Did you remember that? K-A-R-O-B. K-Rob or K-Rob. Carob.
Well, vaguely, because isn't that the name of a chocolate-like substance?
Yeah.
Carob?
Yes.
I don't know. I probably would remember the chocolate-like substance more than one. He used that as his name?
Yeah, he has a picture of himself in 1947, Carob the Magician, and there's nothing...
In 47, that was before he went to Las Vegas, though.
Right. And he does say, he does imply... Yeah, he says he's Carob in Los Angeles.
Yeah, but he started using that, you say, in 47.
Right, and he's introduced in Las Vegas as Carob, but there's no indication he's in drag.
But the picture that you have, he's in drag?
No. The picture is 1947. He's just in a normal, traditional...
Oh, he's a kid.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And then But you don't have any pictures of him in drag, huh?
No, and he doesn't describe that he was in drag. He doesn't say anything about that.
Well, you understand.
Right. But the thing is, you never saw him do that in drag. You just know he mentioned that he did.
Oh, I've seen him dress up in drag at different times, et cetera, like holidays and Halloween and stuff, and he would get into a certain mood and all the rest of it.
But he didn't, you never saw him dressed in drag as a magician?
No, no, that I never saw. It's just at various times I'd seen him that because of Halloween or something like that, he'd get dressed up in drag, and he'd really look like a woman, I'll tell you.
Was he blonde, brunette?
No, he just fluffed up his hair.
That means he'd be brunette then, I guess.
Yeah, but he had curly, fluffy hair.
Yeah, there's a picture of that. Okay, so the thing is that one interesting note is that when he was working in Portland, you know, a year or two before he went to Las Vegas, when he was on that scene or around the same time, he met Johnny Ray when Johnny Ray was nobody.
Yeah, well, I did too.
At that time, or?
I was on a radio show with Johnny Ray. It was called Stars of Tomorrow.
Well, tell us about that. Where was that?
Well, let's see. That would have been, let's see. We moved.
The
family moved from Kansas to Vancouver, Washington in 43. In 44, we moved back to Denver. So it could have been as late as 45. And there was a Uncle Nate, they called him, who ran the Stars of Tomorrow show. And it was kids that come in.
A TV show?
Huh?
A TV show? What?
No, it was radio.
Okay.
That was before TV.
Yes.
We would sing this song, Stars of Tomorrow, shining here today, throw off all your sorrow, da-da-da-da-da-da, life is what you make it, let's make our life worthwhile. Come on, everybody. Smile, smile, smile. And Jane Powell was there, but she was called Suzanne Burse, the Oregon Victory Girl.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she was 15. I think I was 15. Let's see. I was 15 or 16, because, see, I'm born in 28, so I guess I was 15 or 16. Anyway, Johnny Ray was there, and he had his hearing aid and everything else, and he was a screaming faggot. there's stories about him, but that's side issue. You wanted to talk about Bob and Johnny Ray. So.
Yeah. No, it's interesting that you met him, and then he met him himself in the gay underworld, I think.
Probably.
Yeah.
Which Portland. I hadn't contacted, apparently, quite yet.
Yeah.
Within the next year, I did.
Okay. So you think this radio thing was 44, 45, that period?
Yeah.
Okay. I want to just read one more paragraph, then we're going to go into who lived at the
time. What does he say about Johnny Ray? Does he say anything more?
He says that, okay, he says about Johnny Ray, he was in the club. When he was hanging around in Portland, he was hanging around with the entertainers in one of the places. So it seems to be quite far back. Did I write that down?
Maybe this is after he came back from Hollywood?
No, this is before. He met him. He met him when he first was... I'm going to go back here. I can't find it, but anyway.
Well, that's all right.
Yeah, what happened is that he hung around with these people, and Johnny Ray was there, and he said Johnny Ray had a show where he would sing off key, and everybody liked it. And then there was some woman who helped him help Johnny Ray work out his musical arrangements. I can't find it at this point. But anyways, he does say that after he's in Hollywood, after Bob's there, Johnny Ray goes down there and he's successful. He becomes famous pretty quickly.
That's when he sang that song, "A Little White Cloud That Cried."
Okay.
You know, it's like it goes, "When your sweetheart sends a letter of goodbye."
Yeah.
It's very famous.
Just a side thing, you mentioned the Bohemian in passing on page 38. He does mention the Bohemian. He needs to get a job. He'd been up in the Mount Hood, and he comes back, and he says there was a restaurant on the ground floor of the building where he kept a studio, the Bohemian. It's a big landmark kind of a place. There must be something to do there, so he got a job as a waiter. So you're right, that was the... what he was doing, and that's right when he starts really getting involved with the Vedanta Center.
Uh-huh. And we went through all that.
Yeah. Okay, so what happens is Connie moves into the center, but continued to work...
Center of Integration.
Yes, at the Center of Integration, and this would be 54, 55. Well, wait a minute. No. 56. It's 56, because you were...
It would be after September 56, probably... October, November, somewhere in there.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, because we worked that out. I don't know if that was on air or not.
56, yeah.
Yeah. So he says, Connie moved into the center but continued to work at a local store nearby. Do you remember the local store?
Yeah, he worked in the supermarket.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, at some point I think he managed it, but I don't think necessarily at that point.
He says, Connie began to take over different jobs at the house. We were a merry bunch, living our lives and working together in an experiment to see if one could live in a relationship with one another. Of course, there were problems, but we made some effort to solve them. There were five of us living together. Now, this is where it gets interesting. Besides Connie and myself, there was Dr. Ralph Doobie.
Yeah, well, he came in later, but anyway, the...
Yeah, in your mind, you were there before Doobie. So he spells it D-U-B-E-Y. He spells it wrong.
Well, on purpose.
Ah, okay.
There was, D-U-B-Y.
Yeah, D-U-B-E-Y. D-U-B-Y is the correct spelling, right?
Right.
So he says there was Dr. Ralph Doobie, who gave lectures on psychology. That's how he's described.
Uh-huh.
Then there was an Indian named Banarsi. Banarsi.
Yeah, I remember Banarsi. Banarsi.
Yeah, that was
who eventually opened the Indian restaurants and brought his family over. And he was going to the university, I guess.
Yes, and Banarsi, he is. That's the Indian you were trying to think of.
No, there's another one.
Shivananda.
Shivananda. Yes.
Yeah.
Did it say what Shivananda's first name was?
No, he says Banarsi, an Indian who worked at Boeing.
Oh.
And Shivananda, also an Indian. And then Bob says, I met Shivananda early in 1952 when he was giving some lectures and demonstrations of Hatha Yoga.
Yeah. They traveled.
Yeah, he had just come to this country from India hoping to become a well-known teacher. However, after some time, he gave up his aspirations and got a special visa to study at the University of Washington, getting a degree in commerce. That's what you just said. He was at the university.
Commerce. Well, he was. I know he was particularly taking international law, but that's okay.
Okay. After opening the center, he contacted Bob, and so he had met him, and then he lost contact with him or something, and then he reconnects with Bob at the center, and later moved in and taught some basic classes in yoga. And he goes, what a turnaround. But I guess he meant the university and then yoga, going back and forth, the commerce and yoga. But both pursuits had the same goal, Bob says, about this guy. He says, these were the inmates of the ashram.
He's really doing a job there because Doobie didn't show up for a while, and I'm not sure. I know he became a part of the LSD therapy, but it's like I don't think he even had a session himself. Doobie didn't have a session to start with until after. I think we'd had about 5 or 10 sessions already, and then he came in, and that was hilarious.
Okay, we'll get to that, but when we get into the fright nights. But the thing is, what? Who do you remember being there between Connie and Bob and yourself and the two Indians?
Let's see. I'm not sure whether. See, I had an apartment in the basement for a time. There was a second time where Chris was, and I had a room on the opposite end of the hall. It was like a master suite, except it wasn't the master suite.
And that was you and Vern Christensen, who was called Chris.
I know when I took, the very first time I took acid, we had that room, and I came home, and Chris didn't cotton to responding to me, and that's when I went up to Bob and Connie's, and they responded, because by that time it was like 1 or 2 in the morning. And
Vern had not taken the acid. Chris Vern?
No, he hadn't taken it. Yeah, I was the only one who had.
Okay, and so you and Vern were living in the same room. You were lovers at that time.
Yes.
Yeah. So, is
we'd had kind of a split up for a little bit, and then we got back together.
Right, and we'll talk a bit more about Vern later. But the thing is, were Banarasi and Shivananda gay?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, it wasn't a gay commune. It was that was
no. Shivananda, I think, maybe was a partner with Bob when they traveled and stuff, and he was a specialist in Tantra.
Yeah.
Tantric yoga. So anyway, he had many ladies coming around to take the test, so to speak.
Okay, so it was Phyllis or Marie, the women at the center when you were there, living there.
Yes.
Phyllis Goodall.
No, Phyllis Goodall was not there. Marie was.
So there
Marie had the same room. It was in the middle of the second floor. You know, she was in the middle room, and there was 2 bedrooms west and 2 bedrooms east. You know.
Okay. So the interesting thing is that he does not remember you being there at this point in the book. He doesn't
mention it.
Yeah, he doesn't mention.
He doesn't include me in his little story about what his. But go ahead.
Yeah, we will. I will just say, the first mention of you is on page 91. We're at page 75. On page 91, and we'll go into the reason. But what's interesting, he spells you Wooster, W-H-O-S-T-E-R.
W-H-O-S-T-E-R.
Wooster.
I've never heard anybody spell my name that way before. With the accent on who?
yeah, Hooster. Who? The Hooster. The Trickster.
Yeah, well, of course, they used to call me a Trickster and Tripmaster.
So that's embedded in there, Hooster.
I suppose.
He mentions you later on page 138, and you're David Wooster now, W-O-O-S-T-E-R.
So he's changed it again.
Yeah, that's right. He doesn't want to focus on it for some reason.
Uh-huh.
Do you think he's protecting you, just changing the spelling? Or
protecting me? Shit. Not after the things that I know.
Right. Okay, I mean, we're saying he's changing people's names like Ralph Doobie, and he's being kind, changing their names.
And Reinhardt.
Yeah, and Reinhardt. Is he changing your name for the same purpose, maybe?
It's
hard to tell. Well, we'll go into...
He's a trickster. Anyway, it goes to show that if there's some things I've told you that he's left out, you see the procedure, what's gone on.
Yeah.
Because, anyway...
Okay, we're going to go on to the next person, which is who's a very important person. And
in other words, you're not jumping ahead to 91 and et cetera. You're taking care of the people right there in the house. The next person in the house is what?
Well, he says we're going to talk about a person who visits, who's a very important person in your life, and you'll see in a minute. But he says, these five people, we were the inmates of the ashram. We all had our separate lives but lived together under one roof. So that's the end of that. So then...
Well, he's leaving me out, but
yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Now, he then goes into, and he ends a chapter with this very important encounter in his life, in a way, with Swami Aghananda Bharati.
Yeah.
So here's how he describes...
We called him Aghi.
Aghi?
Aghi.
How do you spell that? A-U...
Oh, I don't know. A-U-G-I-E.
Yeah,
Aghi.
Aghi. And now he says his real name is Leopold Fischer.
It is.
Okay, because I thought you called him George. Who was the guy who was called George something in my memories of you talking about Bharati?
Oh, I think Leopold, I think he also, it may have been Leopold George or something.
Right.
In other words, I don't recall him referring, but you can find that information in the book he wrote called The Ochre Robe.
Yes.
Which
and
he had written before he showed up with us, and there was an interesting story that...
Okay, before you go into that, because I have, I'm going to give you...
Okay, go ahead.
I'm going to give you what who says about him, but I just want to go into how he meets him. Does this sound correct? Bob says, I would often go to Vancouver and Victoria, B.C., where we had a small study group. And is that before the LSD?
I think it was. Aghi got involved with the LSD and brought the Dalai Lama's brother over.
Dalai Lama's brother, yes.
Yeah, but that was probably afterwards because...
So he had a study group in Vancouver and Victoria, B.C. before the acid, right?
And Aghi's mother was in Victoria.
Okay.
She was a... His father had been the sugar baron of Austria.
Okay, but we'll get into...
And so when she retired to Vancouver, she was like the grand duchess of that famous hotel there with high key and all the rest of it. But the thing that Aghi said when they came down, he said, well, if there was a place that the world needed enema, Victoria is a place where they put it, apply it.
Is this a hotel in Victoria or in Vienna? The
no, hotel in Victoria. You know, she lived, okay. You know, there's a grand hotel in Victoria.
Okay, so here's what he says. On one trip, when in Victoria, my host mentioned that she read a news item in the local paper about a Swami in town who was a European by birth, but who had lived in India for some time. He was visiting his mother, see, you're right, who had emigrated from Germany. I thought that I might call on him, see what he was about. So he arrived at the apartment where he was staying and rang the doorbell. A voice said, who's there? I stated my name and said I would like to see the Swami. I was buzzed in. I found the right door and was led into a small apartment. There, lounging on a sofa, a large head peeking out of a great mound of saffron-colored cloth, was Swami Aghananda Bharati. Come in," he ordered, and pointed to a small chair for me to sit on. He rose from the sofa and stood over 6.5 feet tall.
He was 6'8".
Yeah, I guess he must have weighed about.
Go ahead.
I guessed he must have weighed about 300 pounds. An imposing character.
At least. Yeah.
Yeah. His robes draped over his body like a tent.
Big eyes, bald head, thick glasses.
Okay, I introduced myself, and he in turn asked me what interest I had in Hindu philosophy, yoga, mysticism, etc. I began my usual history of how I had attended the Ramakrishna Vedanta Society and so on, but he quickly interrupted me by telling me that he had been a monk with the Ramakrishna Math in Kolkata. Bob says, with the wave of his hand, he said that he didn't like the Ramakrishna mission, but had spent some time in the Himalaya Mountains as an acolyte. And then he goes into his history, and Bob says later, I found Agananda charming, intellectual, appealing, and honest, but also bluntly critical of the great Indian heritage. You agree with that?
Oh, yes.
After some time, he told me some jokes to see if I was a prude, I think. No, not I. We laughed together. So he extended his invitation for him to come to Seattle, and then he did. So do you remember him coming to Seattle?
Yes. Yes, I was there when he came.
So that was accurate, his description of how he met him. You would say, you would agree with that?
Pretty much.
Okay, I'm now going to read you what... do you know what happened to him after he left Seattle? Do you know the history and when he died?
I don't know all of it. I know he eventually... You know, we set up the circumstances for him to talk to the UW.
Yes.
As a matter of fact, they had a faculty... All the faculty came, and when the guy went there and talked, the president of the university set aside $300,000 for the Asian Studies Group and wanted them to ask him to come and teach. And he had an appointment at Columbia to go, and he says, I can't tell you for sure. I've got several places that are giving me offers. But he made a deal that if they would let him teach Tibetan and let him, in other words, have them officially sanction a translation of Tibetan Tantric Yoga, that he would come, because he didn't think he'd get very many places to do that. And they said yes, and then he was responsible for bringing all these Tibetans. Before too long, there were 70 Tibetans, the largest Tibetan colony in the United States, and that's because we sponsored him, he sponsored them, etc. Now, after that...
You say we, you mean the center or the university?
Yeah, the center... was his entree into the university. And then the university was the entree into his position there.
Yes.
But after he left there, I don't know when or how, because it was a long period of time I think he was around. But I think I heard that he went back and taught at Syracuse as George Fisher. George Fisher, there it is again.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, let me tell you what Bob says. He says, Agananda stayed with us. Do you remember him staying with you? I guess he would when he taught, right, when he gave classes.
I'm trying to... I think, in the basement at that time, and so, yes, I believe he did have... I think he had the room that Chris and I stayed in later.
Okay, because the, Bob likes him because he's cynical or skeptical or critical of the Indian heritage, so he leans toward a Krishnamurti view. Bob says the Swami was interviewed by, I guess, the Seattle Times, and an article on him with his picture appeared in the paper. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah.
The photo showed the Swami dressed in his robes holding a Hindu rosary. His lecture series was well attended by the center's friends, and there was an influx of new people into the center. And then Bob says, I'm sure the local Swami at the Vedanta Center was shaking in his sandals when he read the piece in the paper, and is wondering, who is this Westerner, and what do Westerners know about true Indian philosophy?
Yeah, but he had, when he left the Ramakrishna group, he went into, well, he wandered. You have to read the book.
He traveled all over India as a wandering monk.
Yes, but particularly he met a guy who told him he should be Shankaracharya. Shankaracharya was so exclusive that only a born Brahmin could be in it. And he went up to the Himalayas to try to appeal to them, and they said, well, we can't do that, but I'll tell you what you do. You wait outside, and we'll argue about it. And they argued for hours, and then they invited him in. They said, all right, we figured that we will ask you certain questions, and if you can answer them, then we will do it. Well, they asked him questions, and he blew their mind so much that they decided that he was the resurrection of their founder, of the whole Shankaracharya, and made him an abbot of 16 or 18 monasteries. And then he went to Banaras University and lectured and studied all the rest of it until someone looked over the transom and caught him doing kundalinis with his shakti. And everybody, they got a group of cars filled with their officials and him and whisked him off to the airport. And all the way to the airport, on both sides of the street were Hindus, and they thought there was going to be a riot, but all these Hindus were sticking their tongue in and out at him as he went out to the airport to escape.
Because he'd been doing some tantra sex? Is that what you said?
Yeah, well, I know, but it's like that was officially a no-no.
Yeah, and he was, you're saying they're sticking their tongue out because the word is
because that's what he was doing to the girl.
Right.
Giving her kundalinis.
But it wasn't, they weren't sticking out, you know, insulting. They were just referring to what they'd heard he'd done.
Well, I don't know what you would call it, but it was a statement from them that they all knew what he was doing. And, I mean, both sides of the road all the way to the airport was lined up with these men doing that. And the people that were in the cars that were taking him there were terrified of a riot before they got there.
And were these villagers or monks that were doing lined up?
It was people.
Okay, so
probably students, all kinds. Because he taught at the university, but this must have gotten out. From Banaras to the airport, how far was it? I don't know. I just heard the story.
Okay, he says.
He Bob, told the story.
Yeah, he was a monk for a year, and he didn't like being a monk, and so he walked out. He said, Bob says that he later became a swami in Varanasi, was initiated into the Bharati order, and had traveled all over India as a wandering monk. He spoke some 17 Indian languages and taught at several Indian universities.
He's covered it there. Yeah. You read the Oka Robe, you'll find the difference, but...
Okay. So it says Agananda stayed with us and continued to hold open classes. One day he visited the Department of Far Eastern Studies at the University of Washington, where he made a strong impression.
That was the first week.
First week?
And that Times article was the first week.
Right. They offered him a position in Buddhist studies. That's a bit... That was a bit quick. I mean, you're saying that the president and them came and heard him lecture? Or he lectured to them?
No, somebody had come to hear him lecture at the Center of Integration. And they arranged, through the president, for him to speak. And when word got out, the president decided to have the entire faculty of the University of Washington hear him.
Mm.
Which was a very extraordinary thing for anybody to do anytime, but for anybody to do it on such short notice was quite phenomenal. And then, of course, the coup de grace was the president set aside $300,000 for that department with the intention of getting him to come.
Right. Now,
that was all within the first 10 days or so, you know,
right,
of his and that, showing up.
Yeah, and is that that's how impressive he is. And was this before you guys had the LSE sessions?
Or, oh, yeah.
This is before. Okay, one thing he says, Agananda made no pretense about being spiritual or being anyone's guru. On the contrary, he made it perfectly clear that he thought that the so-called traveling yogis who were out to make a buck or establish some sort of a mystical organization grossly misrepresented yoga and other Indian methods. Agananda was a critical and intelligent debunker of all the misinformation that had spread out of India during the past 100 years or so. Bob Carr says, I welcomed his comments and felt that what he was saying was perhaps disappointing to some. But I knew.
Yeah, it was a breakthrough in America of what was really going on. Because all these other things were like shams and shamans and stuff that were, you know, some of them were very well trained in India, but so many of them were Ramakrishna. Do you know the story of Ramakrishna?
No, let's hear that.
Ramakrishna's father worked for the English and spoke only English, and Ramakrishna only spoke English. But he had fits. What do you call them?
Epileptic fits?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he'd go in these epileptic fits, and when he'd come out, he'd talk in English, and people would write down what he said and then translate it into Hindi. So there's all kinds of people all over India thought that Ramakrishna spoke Hindi, but he didn't. And he was actually kind of a stoop, but when he'd go into these things, and he'd come out and say certain things, and then the scribes would kind of twist them to fit into the Indian lore. And somehow or other, somebody got a lot of money and traveled all over America setting up Ramakrishna centers. There was probably 15 or 20 of those centers that were set up all over the country. And so that's what everybody knew. And here it was all the way... I think it was even let's see. I don't know which one it was. Somebody said it was like if one went to the Pentecostal church and tried to talk about Catholicism. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was... Somebody made that reference. It may have been Augie himself. I'm not sure. But at any rate, one time he was lecturing on Buddhism, and this woman said, you know...
Who was lecturing? Augie or...
Augie was lecturing on Buddhism. And she says, you know, you say you're a Hindu, but you sure sound like a Buddhist. He says, well, intellectually, I'm a Buddhist, but emotionally, I'm a Hindu. Because I like Hinduism because it suits my emotional needs, but as far as truth, the Buddhism was it, and of course that's why he wanted to go into more Tibetan stuff.
Right, now the interesting thing, looking on Wikipedia, here's the guy's history. I mean, he's dead by 1886. I mean, it's a long time.
Who?
Ramakrishna dies in 1886. That's all.
Uh-huh.
It says he was a rustic Bengali religious ecstatic. See, there it is, ecstatic.
How nice, how kind.
And he said, yeah, Dave, I'm an ecstatic. You know, it's my element.
Been there, done that.
Yeah, I do 10 versions of controlled schizophrenia. And you know, on my chart, I actually am in the ecstasy quadrant, so that's interesting.
Uh-huh. Now, what do you mean, ecstasy quadrant?
Well, on my chart, there's 5 states, panic, paranoia, hysteria, schizophrenia, and ecstasy, and I put myself in the ecstasy quadrant.
Well, you mean as a Gemini?
No, as my being. Whereas McLuhan's in schizophrenia, LaRouche is in paranoia, William Aaron Thompson is in hysteria, and Arthur Coker, the postmodernist, is in panic. And so it's code for the kind of things they write about.
And what about me?
You're in the Thompson. Well, I have Krishnamurti in the Thompson quadrant, which would be hysteria, and I include the Cosmic Awareness Gang in the Krishnamurti effect.
Hysteria?
Yes, hysteria. Yeah, what that means is that Krishnamurti was too worried about the death of nature. He was an ecologist, a greenie, an eco-fascist, you know, to put it into.
Huh.
But now we're getting to Bob's cosmology, but I don't want to get distracted. We'll go into that some other time if you want to. But
I don't care.
I know. That's good. So let me say what Ramakrishna, what they say. So he's a Bengali religious ecstatic who practiced Vaishnava and Sakti Bhakti, Vedanta, Tantra, and other spiritual disciplines. Now, this confirms what you say. The next sentence. Toward the end of his life, he became a guru to anglicized Bengalis. See, there's the English community, right? And he says, including the future Swami Vivekananda.
Uh-huh.
And also became an influential figure in the Bengali.
In other words, after he was known for a long time in India, somebody in his later life came up with the thing to spread it.
Yes. British intelligence maybe set that up. And he also became an influential figure in the Bengal Renaissance. He was considered an avatar or incarnation of God by many of his disciples and is considered as such by many of his devotees today. But
when Agayananda went to India to go to that, because that's where he'd heard about it in Europe, and so he thought that was it. And so he goes there, and after he's there for a time, I think he was there as long as 2 years, but at any rate, someplace he started asking questions, and they didn't like that, and so he started looking into things anyway, and they threw him out, and he had no place to go, and he had no foundation, no nothing. He was naked and alone in a strange land, and he's wandering around, and that's when he came across the guy who saw that he was great and said, "You must come to meet my guru." And this is an old man. And so he takes him to an older old man. And he learns a lot. But the old man dies, and they both go through the process of incinerating him. But he's gotten from that the clue and the connection to go to the Shankaracharya, but when he gets there, they say, "No, you're not a born
Brahmin,
and the story I told you ensues.
Yeah.
But he went there under what he felt was false pretenses that Ramakrishna's whole thing. So a lot of his bombast is about that at all. The way in which it affected the West, and the West didn't know the truth and didn't have any way of why it didn't know the truth.
Right. You're saying that most of the interest in India in the late 19th century was due to the Ramakrishna...
All the way up to the time that Agayananda Bharati showed up.
So when he lectured...
There was nobody else that was castigating falseness. Or if they were, nobody heard them. With him, with a few phrases and a wave of his hand, he could make an impression that would cause people to realize that, my God, here's all this foundation of everything that we thought had to do with it, and it's false.
Amazing. And now this... When he lectured at the center, when he first came, he would immediately go into this stuff, and that's why everybody was impressed, right?
Mm-hmm.
Finally, they heard a new angle on the whole Eastern fascination, right?
Yeah, and he loved jokes.
Yeah, that's mentioned.
He collected jokes, especially religious jokes. I remember hearing him tell him, said, "Yeah, I was on this cruise ship, and it started to sink, and there was this rabbi, this priest, and this swami, and Everybody said, for God's sake, somebody do something. So the preacher passed the hat. And then there was this fabulous joke, because he did it with a straight face, because he was a foreigner. And he said something about this officer of the day.
What?
The officer of the day of a military base had to inspect the dining room. And so as he goes in and he's inspecting the dining room, and then he sees this chef with a hairy chest throwing the bread up in the air and catching it on his chest. And he says, my God, what happened? And he says, does he do that all the time? And he says, oh, yes, but you should be around here when he makes donuts. And he looks at all these little old ladies and straight face. He says, what's a donut? And we're in the back of the room just howling with laughter. And then he goes on with his story, but that's the kind of a guy he was.
Right, well, so maybe a lot of the jokes you've told me come from him, these religious
jokes. Some of them, like, probably.
I think one of them, I always remember one you told me when I first met you, something about the humans are up in heaven, and they talk to the cows, and something about, well, do they have sex down there?
Oh, no, that was from Premonon.
Yeah, who's that?
Well, he's the one who steamed up the table. I told you about when Bob and Connie went down in 60 to see Krishnamurti, and Premonon showed up and talked and stayed in their room. And then,
well, who's
anyway,
Premonon? Is he a character?
He was one of the most famous people in India because he had 500 popular songs on the radio. You turn to any radio in India, which everybody had radios,
yeah,
and they had these songs, and almost all the songs were by Premonon.
Wow, so he was a Bob Dylan, you know.
Yeah, and because in India, if you write a song, you have to finish the song with, this is my experience and your name, so that anybody who tried to create a song that wasn't their experience was laughed out, you know. So you had to be authentic, that your song was about your experience. And so he had 500, at least when I knew him, that's what he said. He had 500 songs across India. And I don't know whether he told me, somebody else told me that you couldn't have a song unless it was authentic and it was your experience, because that's the rule.
Right. Now, what was the joke? Can you tell me the joke? I'm trying to remember.
Oh, it's about the guy who it has a whole series of things about deaths and reincarnation.
Yes.
Where it's time for him to go, and he says, no. My wife, well, we'll shorten it. My wife needs a pig. You know, it's gone through different stages.
Yeah.
She needed this, and he'd become that and then die, and then he'd time to go, and then it's a pig. Then when they come to get him, he says, well, I guess I better go. He says, but have you got any female pigs up there? In other words, this fabulous man who had given up going and had done this and this and this, and then his comment, well, I guess I'll go. Do you have any female pigs up there? And the whole thing is, be careful what you do to your conscience in trying to accommodate other people that you love, and you will make yourself so low that you will only think that way.
Yeah, I get it. So how did he steam up? He visited the Krishnamurti Center in 1960 when Bob Carr was there, and he steamed up something? What was that you were saying?
Oh, the coffee table that he ironed.
Oh, yeah.
Steam ironed, and it caused the
thing you got in trouble with.
Oh. That may be one.
That may be why your name's misspelled and everything, you know, and that's why he dropped you.
Oh, I think there were other things. In the first place, when Bob had his first acid session.
Well, okay, we're going to get into that. We'll get
freaked out so much.
Yeah, but Dave, let's hold that. We're going to come into that in a minute. But so back to what's interesting, you're talking about Ramakrishna. I thought you said that Premanand went to Ojai, but you're saying he came while Bob was down in Ojai, and that's when the problem happened. Yeah.
So, and he wanted me to join him on a world tour. And he said, and as far as money's concerned, I met this guy who gave me a carte blanche. All I had to do is contact Hong Kong, and whatever I wanted, I'd get. And I said, oh, you're kidding. He says, well, come on with me. We went down to the Western Union and waited for about an hour, and $500 came. And so he says, I can, anywhere that I go in the world, now I can contact that number and have, he says, of course, if I get money locally, I won't do it. But if I don't, I got an ace in the hole.
And he liked you and wanted you to...
Oh, yeah, we went up in the mountains together, and we sat in meditation looking eye to eye for 5 fucking hours. And at the end of the 5 hours, he's the one who blinked. And nodded and acquiesced.
But he
was a Scorpio.
Well, did you have sex with him?
No, everything but, you know, and it's like potentially it might have gone that direction, although it was never mentioned, but it was like he knew.
So he was a yogi or a meditator, but mainly a singer.
Well, he was a mature lawyer who went on holiday in the Himalayas, and the day that he was getting ready to leave, he decided to go out and had take one more look around away from the lodge. And when he is walking down this path, there's another path that's going up the hill there, and at the bottom is this guy. He says, I've been waiting for you. And he looks at him, he says, me? He says, yes, I've been waiting for you. We must hurry. And motioned him up the path, and they went up to the path into a cave, and here was an older man, and this guy teaches him, and here's a one where then they incinerate him. You know, apparently it's a pattern of action.
They cremate him, is that what you mean?
Yeah. forgot the word.
yeah. Incinerate him. But this is the same pattern as Bharati.
Yeah, at a different time and place. But anyway, then he comes down and collects his belongings and hires some bearers to carry him. And then he could have gone around a mountain, but it's like it would be shorter to go over the mountain. So as they're crossing a stream, he thinks one of the bearers pushed him because they wanted his materials. He didn't know, but so in this mountain freezing stream with only an ochre robe, he falls into the stream, but he manages to get to shore several hundred yards down, and he gets up and out, and he says, when I got up and out, it was as though I was surrounded in light, and as freezing cold as it was, I had no freezing. And he says, and so I walked up to the path, and the two men had continued on with his stuff, and when they see him, they freak out. One of them drops his thing, the other one continues to carry it, and he runs like hell. And when they get over the mountain, they get down to the first lowlands, there's 25,000 people waiting for him. Because the word had spread, and so he starts he's supposed to walk the length of India, you know. So he walked the length of India, meeting crowds like this everywhere he went, all the way.
Because of the light that had
Well, because of somehow or other he had survived all that and was just phenomenal. And, of course, this guy, when he would let out an ohm, his whole frame would shake. And you could feel it. I'm telling you, it was incredible. You know, just one long ohm.